everyone, and welcome, or...
Velkommen.
From Norway! I finally made it to Oslo to take part in Catapult Future Tech on the subject of the future of education. Having flown in via Utah and London, I'm feeling good to be back in the European time zone, having soaked up some international news about Macron, Comey and Jeremy Corbyn running over a journalist's foot. ASU GSV Summit was pretty immense, with a good turnout from European edtechers, and it was great to meet the new CEO of Kahoot, plus reps from the Jefferson Accelerator on efficacy, and hear more about Navitas Ventures' mapping of the edtech landscape. Check that out in the show notes. We had a big spike in listens this week, and an especially big welcome for US peeps listening in. If that includes you, hello and welcome. For those who can make it, also check out what we're up to at London EdTech Week on the 19th of June, where we ask, is EdTech a thing, in collaboration with Nesta and sponsored by Cooley Legal Practice. You can sign up for free, link in the show notes, and a few final sponsorships are still open. Right, before we begin, a quick note from our awesome sponsors at the Japan Prize, so listen up.
Hello.
Hello, good morning to you.
Good morning, how are you?
Good, and you?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, we had a really nice weekend in London. It was very sunny. Perhaps you could explain to listeners what the Japan Prize is.
Okay, my pleasure. First of all, NHK is Japan's public broadcaster. So, and we usually produce almost every genre of content, like TV programs and radio programs. And but also, NHK put much importance on education. And one of the international brands to represent that value, or almost expressing our how determined we are about quality or equal access to education, is the Japan Prize. It's an international competition for educational media. And so we launched this competition in 1965. So we welcome all of the audiovisual content, not only TV programs and videos and films, but also we welcome all the digital contents as well, such as website and games and applications. So this is pretty much about what we are.
And so in terms of who should enter, are there any particular types of digital companies, edtech companies, who should definitely enter? And are there any that you're thinking in the future may be eligible but aren't this time around?
Okay, so because we are public media broadcaster, now we're welcoming the content which has any type of audiovisual contents in their services. So, like website or across, even though it's a cross media content, like teaching kids as programming or coding, mm-hmm. the content should have some sort of audio visual content in that service. So maybe some sort of like a robot who are controlled by the coding, but if that robot doesn't have audio visual contents at the moment, I think I'm sorry to have to tell that I think we have to wait for a little more to come to welcome those contents.
So it's the audio visual bit that's the important aspect.
That's right, yes.
Okay, and then is there a cost to enter?
No, there is no entry fee, so any contents are welcome, and we already opened the call for entry for this year. So you can just simply visit our website, and we have all the entry rules and entry forms. Links are there.
Okay, great. And then the deadline is the 30th of June this year. Is that right?
That's right, yes. Okay, so until that light, we have about two steps to enter. One is the filling out the online entry form. And after we accept the entry form, we will send you the email to your the links to upload your contents. And so the finishing the uploading the contents, it should be done by the deadline, which is just like you said, at end of the June. So that's www.nhk.or.jp/prize.
If people enter and they're successful, what's the benefit? What's the next step if they go on to be nominated or win?
Right, okay. So after the deadline, we have a preliminary selection process during the summer. We are announcing the finalist on September the 1st. And after you are nominated, some of the category, not all the all of the category, but you are welcome to the to present your works in Tokyo. Especially for the EdTech listener, I think it's one of the good news, I hope, is that one category which is heavily focusing on digital content, which we are calling Creative Frontier category, these are five or six finalists are usually nominated as a finalist. And these finalists are invited by NHK. We are paying your travel cost. You are invited to Tokyo to present your project in front of the final jurors.
And that's amazing. So that will,
yeah, so you have a free ticket to Tokyo.
Okay, fantastic. And then the award-giving ceremony, that is in the autumn, is that right?
Yes, the final selection will be scheduled from October 11th to October 18th. The final date, October 18th, is the award ceremony. So this is the one day which we, you know, announced all the winners. And we have a best of the best prize, which is called the Grand Prix Japan Prize. So these are, you know, presented all the winners. And we have a prize money. Each of the best category, we have $2,000 for the winner. And also we have $5,000 for the Grand Prix winners. So I think it's I hope it's a good information for you.
Yeah, no, I think it's very good. I think a lot of people will be excited and interested to enter. So thank you very much for sharing, Yuki. Do you have any final message to potential entrants?
Well, we all the believing in the power of media and the power of technology to change the world for the better place. And the Japan Prize is a very unique place for those people who get together and discuss how the media can communicate to the world in the learning aspect. So we're really looking forward to your submissions, and we're really looking forward to welcoming you to Tokyo in October.
That's great. So thanks very much, Yuki.
Thank you, Sophie.
Alrighty, this week we're in conversation with the inimitable Ted Fujimoto, president from Landmark Consulting Group and co-chair of Right to Succeed. We're talking about how do you scale innovation, what's wrong with most schools, why is charter school versus district school the wrong argument, what's the chronology for success, and why is music so exciting for learning? It's an awesome chat. In fact, one man at South by Southwest EDU just came and sat and listened to us whilst we recorded and apologised afterwards, but said it was so interesting. If that was you, hello. As always, tweet your feedback to @podcastedtech, check out the Patreon campaign and listener survey, and have a great week. I'm back to London and off to go camping with a rabble of two-year-olds and can't wait. Bye-bye. So I'm delighted to be here with Ted Fujimoto, who's president of Landmark Consulting Group. So welcome, Ted.
Thank you for having me.
So first of all, for those who aren't familiar with your work, could you kind of explain who you are and what you do? And
well, I guess I would summarize it as we're obsessed about the biology of engagement. And what that means is how people are engaged, how they drive their organizations, how they build customers, how they engage students. And we love taking things to scale. So in 1996, we helped design the first New Tech High School, which is now the New Tech Network, which has now over 200 schools, growing 20 to 40 schools a year. And no lectures, all projects, all connected to the real world. And that started by, I had moved my company from Silicon Valley to Napa Valley, where I'm from. And what a lot of people don't realize about Napa Valley, which is a beautiful wine country, it's a farm town. And we could not even hire admin assistants that had qualifications to help my company grow, to the point that we thought we'd probably have to move again within the year. We went to school board and basically said, if you don't fix this problem, we have to move. And there were six other biotech companies, right, all trying to make kind of some headway in living this beautiful area, and couldn't get it done. Well, long story short, they threw it back in our lap, and somehow it ended up in my lap of what do you want to see? And I hated school. I had all kinds of schooling experiences, from a single country schoolhouse to a traditional kind of environment, to private tutors, to overseas schools, to the whole hodgepodge. And school was something you just put up with and got through.
Which was the worst of those?
All of them were terrible. And it was terrible because it was so much sit and get. And I call it lecture, memorize, test, and forget. And I knew how to play the game well. There were some classes I showed up for the midterm and finals, and I knew I could just get by, right? And so I had a very mixed view of schooling. And so, we want to start a school. What should it look like? Well, my company had these teams that would take on emerging technologies no one had used before, jump into a brand new sector, a new industry, and develop solutions for them. And somehow they would always come under budget, on time. We won awards. We were an executive briefing center at Microsoft and IBM for a number of years with the stuff we had. And they had this way of working. And they had a way of just getting the stuff done. And so we literally took all of that and we dumped that into the school.
And so just to kind of get my head around it completely, so it's like a design stroke investment lab. Would that be correct? I'm just trying to understand like how you came into it. So what did you study, for example, and then how did you?
I am an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I launched the Landmark my freshman year in college, and by the time I graduated, had almost 30 employees. and
what do you put that down to? How do you go about doing that?
It is about looking for holes and seeing where things are breaking and figuring out what you have to contribute personally or people you can bring together to. Sometimes it's you have the bailing wire. Sometimes you have an elegant solution. Sometimes it's an ugly solution, but it works. Mm. But where are the holes? Where are things breaking?
And so for schools, where do you think the holes are? Schools and higher education, or education in general, where do you think the holes are?
One of the things about the highest performing organizations and schools in the world, and something that they do that's completely opposite of everyone else, is that they put relationships first. It's relationships, trust, respect, responsibility, getting to really authentically know each other, and to the point that it creates a context for figuring out what's relevant to each other. Mm-hmm. And what can we do together, right? And then with relationships and then relevance, now you can do amazing, excellent things. And that's where the rigor comes in. So it's the energy flow is literally relationships, relevance, rigor. Now, if you talk to most educators and teachers and say, how do you improve student achievement? Usually the first answer they have is, we got to increase our expectations and standards, which is rigor first. If that doesn't work as well as we hoped, then we should connect some of that to real world things or something that the kid can relate to. And if that doesn't work, we put them in the principal's office or we give them counseling. Right? So they literally talk about it in the opposite order. It has rigor, relevance, relationships, whereas the highest performing schools have a complete opposite priority set and a different energy flow. That's why when you walk into a school, within minutes, you can tell which kind of environment this is.
That's very true. And so what role does technology have in all of this?
Technology should be an enabler to enhance the core thing that works, right? The enhance the biology of learning. And, you know, I've been walking around some of the exhibits here, and there is so much ed tech that's here, right? And I would say a lot of it is very poorly designed. And the reason is that there's not a pedagogical basis for it. So they start with rigor. And they try to engage people by fancier graphics, fancier so-called stories, fancier whatever it is, trying to make up for the fact that they never are approaching their users as, how can I make you care about our relationship together so that we can go on this journey or do this thing together?
And who do you think is executing on that well and has that ordering correctly in terms of ed tech or innovative companies out there?
You know, it's very nascent. I see hints of it. And when I talk to those teams, they don't know why they're doing it. They just are patterning after what they believe is successful. And but what they're really doing is they got lucky and they're patterning after some good stuff. But it's not enough to keep them centered. So, you know, my advice to them has been, know why this works, and you got to stick to that biology of engagement and that flow. And when you understand that, then you can hold the line so that over time you don't start drifting into something else.
And so you've still got this huge network of schools across the states.
Yes.
Yeah. And do you go into those schools often?
You know, they
ban you.
I've had about 6 designs, and between the 6, they've created over 700 schools, and they're growing about 100 a year. And it's really difficult to even keep track of the locations and the names. But I try to get out to at least a dozen schools a year, and especially helping facilitate, bring teams to those schools to really understand, because many people in the education world, even educational leaders who get write-ups and everything, they have never stepped foot in a high-performing school in their life. And they're trying to talk about it. They're trying to make policies about it. They're trying to create initiatives around it in this abstraction.
Do you have anyone in mind in particular?
Where should I start? Yeah. But it's a very interesting thing. It's like a community that's all had one-star motels and hotels. And for the first time, they're trying to imagine bringing in a 5-star, but no one ever seen one or have experienced one.
I'm just trying to visualize, so one of your schools. So I'm imagining the sort of design layout is not, you know, an average classroom. So could you describe, say, perhaps one of those? And, you know, if you were to walk in, what does it look like? And
so I would say that you walk into the school and the first thing that you'll realize is, wow, some of the major biotech and tech companies could just move in here and be very productive. But the first thing that you'd probably see is a very warm greeting and what is happening, where do you need to go, and a display of student work, of what are the products, what are the amazing things that the school is proud of what is being produced here. And then you walk in, and what you'll see is teams of students all over the building working on whatever they're working on. And it's amazing the level of engagement. You might walk in on a weekend, you might walk in at 8 o'clock at night, and you'll still see kids working on their things. And what's interesting is we take communities to visit schools and kind of all day deep dive into these school designs. And there's been a couple of instances they've walked into a classroom and they've come back at the end of the tour and said, you know, we were looking to talk to the teacher and we didn't know who the teacher was. And the principal is like, oh, I forgot to, she called in sick and I forgot to bring in a sub. And the kids were on task, they were doing their thing, right?
It's quite a flat structure.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And students are truly in control and power of their work and their environment and the culture. And there's no bullying. And if it even starts to show its head, the students shut it down. I mean, this is a violation of how we have agreed to in our relationships with each other.
And what about international schools? Do you have any international schools?
There are some big picture schools in Australia, New Zealand, and Netherlands, and Israel. And there's been more interest. New Tech has some in Australia, and the first one in China. So there's been quite a bit of international delegations coming to look at, be able to replicate these school designs.
So I interviewed the CEO of the National Charter Schools Alliance earlier in the week.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm trying to build up my knowledge of the US education system as well. But I just wondered if you had a view on some of the policies that are being discussed around sort of choice and vouchers and the charter school movement. And I'm becoming more familiar with the fact that
there are quite a few people now homeschooling their children as well.
Yes.
But which all seems to be sort of tied up in perhaps a realization that the average school that you might be able to go to isn't necessarily serving who are individuals very well, people who are individuals.
That's right. And I help set up some of the state associations for the charter movement. So I'm very familiar with them. I've probably visited over 3,000 charter schools around the country, half of them. I mean, it's close.
Just a few. Yeah,
a few. Yeah. I would say that there's a big flaw in the whole choice movement. And choice by itself is not good enough. We've all gone to that town where our choices of restaurants and the hotels are dire. And the other big flaw is the idea that autonomy by itself will create quality. Mm-hmm. And if you dump a whole bunch of people into a 5-star building, it doesn't turn into a Ritz-Carlton overnight. It might never turn into Ritz-Carlton. And so it has to go hand in hand. And I think, you know, with innovation and creativity and the obsession about that, yes, we want people to be creative. Yes, we want them to be innovative. But we also need to have a hardcore realization that, you know, we all use technology. I have a bunch of Apple products, right? And I'm a fan of the Tesla car, right? We can talk about how brilliant the design is and what they could do next and how, in their strategy, how they got here. But very few of us could actually design the product. Mm-hmm. Very few people, and even fewer people, could actually create the company that designs those products. And at some point, are you the user and operator, or are you the inventor? And I think it's only 2-3% of the population that truly have all the right ingredients and environment to be able to make that magic happen. There's a lot of really amazing people who are creative and inventive that are stuck in environments that are not set up to allow for that to happen. That's why most innovations come out of entrepreneurial companies that are started from scratch, not within. Yeah, right. And so that's an important distinction. So, you know, that's where I've been really working with whole school designs, and where a community can choose one or more designs to implement in their existing schools, where so we're not asking you to try to invent something from scratch, try to get legs underneath it, try to test it, and try to operate all at the same time, because there's only about 2% of the population that pull that one off.
Have you met Stephen Heppel in the UK? Are you familiar with him?
I have not.
Okay, so I guess he does something similar and has schools around the world. But yeah, thinking about that, you know, right from scratch, the design element of the school and how that allows for collaborative learning, and you know, down to the point of you know, the amount of light in a room, the amount of oxygen in a room, and how that affects learners as well. But yeah, it's just interesting. And in terms of investing, do you invest in edtech companies as well?
I advise a number of investment funds. We have invested through my clients over $1 billion in innovative school spaces and real estate. We have been trying to push investment funds, investors, to look at pedagogy as a baseline for viability of product, because there's so much noise in this market, as we mentioned, and that is a distinguishing factor of whether you're going to have long-term engagement with users of your product, and they don't spend enough time in that.
And are there any either sort of social impact investors or accelerators, because there's so many out there, that you think are doing a sort of a good job that you would point towards? Just because, you know, daily I'm kind of following these new incubators or accelerators that are popping up, and I think it's useful for listeners trying to get a grasp of, okay, you know, the ones that do have that pedagogical underpinning as well.
I think everyone's muddling around in this area.
Yeah.
Just deeper learning, project-based learning, and just the awareness that these designs even exist in this country came about with a very concerted effort, a number of individuals, including myself, at the federal and state levels of creating this awareness. But this is in the last 3 to 5 years. So just the notion of the idea of what criteria do you use to invest, pedagogy probably in this last year or two has been coming into as one of the elements. Mm-hmm. And it's unfortunately not one of the primary elements as they, because I view that as a number one predictor.
Yeah, I think like people in the UK now are certainly much more savvy to, you know, if you're going to engage with an edtech startup, do they have an educator on the board or on the advisory board, or, you know, just so that they're not just kind of removed from this thing and sort of having a punt at what they think would be a good idea as well.
And it's one thing to have the token educator on the board, but it's also to have one that understands pedagogy mm-hmm. in a way that's innovative. And they are out there, but it's about you seeking the right ones out with the right mindset, because that's where the magic is.
Next up, a word from Class Central, which, if you're into geeking out over online learning and MOOC reports like I am, you'll probably already know about. Unless you've been asleep, MOOCs or massive online open courses are changing the way we experience higher and further education and workplace learning. With significant online courses available, gaining insight into this fast-paced world is worth spending time on, especially for those implicated by such changes. That's where Class Central comes in. Not only does it list hundreds of courses, and importantly, including non-profit courses as well as the big Ivy League unis, but the MOOC Report blog has some excellent analysis on what's up, down, new, or just slightly left-field. So definitely go and check it out at class-central.com/report and let me know what you think. So one question I always ask my interviewees is, are there any books that you perhaps read, and it doesn't have to be to do with education or what you do, but that you always go back to that have had an impact on how you conduct yourself and your kind of thinking or philosophy of life, should I say?
Well, right about the same time we created the first New Tech School, I was part of a venture group that acquired the consulting company that came up with the whole Saturn car company retailing concept and re-engineered 11 automotive and hospitality brands worldwide. And that's about how do you get a bunch of redneck, bullheaded, stubborn auto dealers to do something completely different. Their people, their capital, their buildings, and how do you replicate that 1,100 times in like a 7-year period? Or as a Ritz-Carlton, how do you double the number of your hotel locations? Most of them in foreign countries you've never done business before. And many of those on islands where you're literally hiring 2/3 of the workforce off that island who live in huts. Mm-hmm. And on day one, you have to deliver a world-class 5-star experience, not 2 years from now, day one, right? How do you do that? And that was such an eye-opening experience, because this company had a legacy of working with some of the top brands in the world and creating these amazing experiences. And how do you replicate mindset and culture? Because many people view it as a soft, amorphous thing that you can't replicate that. You can't sit, but there is a way to embed that and make it sustainable over a long period of time. So one of the books that has been very influential on me is around the standards and the culture mm-hmm. of Ritz-Carlton, their golden thread. And it's and even how they articulate what they do. Because what we find in working with schools, and we call it codifying their design, is educators left to their own devices by default will either make kind of go to one or the other extreme of documenting procedures, everything that we're doing. And you can't replicate 1,000 things that you're doing. And that's equivalent to a hotel saying, having a smile policy, and this actually existed in a hotel chain that had to get acquired. And so 6 seconds, you have to smile at a person.
Which is kind of the Hillary Clinton experience as well.
Yes. Yeah. And what happens when you run into someone in the hall or in the elevator? Pretty soon you have this little, you know, inch-thick manual about how to be friendly and smile, right? Well, guess no, it's fake. And it's not appropriate for me to smile if I know you had a family member pass away. Mm-hmm. And so it becomes this rote thing that gets poorly executed. And then the other error is, everything stated as goals. We want personalized learning. We want authentic learning. We want engagement. Well, how is that going to actually happen? What leads up to guarantee that that happens? And there's got to be some structure and protocols and rituals in place to ensure that that happens. So it's not an either or, yeah. It's articulating in the right way so that the time and space for people to not only connect but calibrate around these big ideals and to calibrate their execution is so important. All of a sudden, assessment and inspection seems so rote and so ineffective, which it has been.
So it's about the culture and developing that. It's funny that you said that because I'm always blown away by the hospitality experience in Asia. So I'm just thinking about staying in a hotel in Kuala Lumpur when I was there with my previous job, and just the quality of how they go about that. And I was talking to someone this morning that I always feel slightly ashamed of the same thing in Japan, like, you know, people are so polite, and then when they come to London it must just be a bit of a shock. But
it is a shock.
Yeah, yes. So sorry about that. But, and then were you speaking whilst you were out at South by Southwest EDU?
I was on a panel. Okay. With Oracle Academy,
yes, right.
Talking about computer science in education.
And so what's your take on that? I'd like to just sum that up.
So the big summary is people are so obsessed with coding. Mm-hmm. And I'm working with a number of teams that are working on billion-dollar projects. And the stuff I've seen, coding, I'm afraid, is going to be the keyboarding classes that we had. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be 10, 15 years behind of the skills that kids will actually need to get the best jobs. And we didn't take keyboarding to use our smartphones. And coding is kind of like that, because with the technology and what technology is doing in coding itself is quite profound. Mm-hmm. If you think about even how grandmother uses the smartphone and all the things are happening there, or even when we have a PowerPoint presentation, we're dragging and dropping a mm-hmm. graphic on that. There's stuff happening behind that before used to require code to make that happen, right? And so the skill that's really needed is around creativity and systems thinking. Mm-hmm. How do you connect the imperfect things in the world and integrate them so they work together in unison? Just like, how do you connect people with different priorities and different things? And how do you form a strong culture and a way of communication channels so that and healthy communication channels so they can be productive? And it's going to be very interesting, because as technology starts to be able to teach itself, and we're already seeing this with some of the Facebook images, and said, no, that's me, that's not me, and it's learning, is that our role as good technologists is going to end up being good mentors to technology, just like training a dog or raising a child, mm-hmm. because you got to be very careful about what you expose them to, because technology can go in weird directions when you expose them wrong things. Kids can go in really weird directions if you expose them to the wrong things or a lack of perspective. So the number one skill is about being coaching and mentoring.
It's really interesting, because yesterday I was speaking to, I don't know if you've met them out here, but the chatbot company from Norway.
Yes.
Yes. And really fascinating co-founder there. And we're having a great conversation. And, you know, he was saying exactly this about chatbots, because I said, you know, that's great. But, you know, what's your opinion on what will happen to all those people that used to do that administrative work? And he said, well, you know, in the first instance, they will be required to help train the chatbot. So, that kind of point of view about passing on that knowledge, and, you know, there's still need the initial training that will need to happen for the technology and acting as that mentor that you sort of describe, process.
Yes, so we all become teachers and mentors in the most profound way, not just to each other as people, but to our technology.
And the responsibility that goes with that. So
that's right.
Do you do any work with the Singularity University or any of those kind of guys?
I know some of the founders there, yeah. And I'm a big fan of what they're doing. And that I wish more education, higher education institutions operate like them, because they're so tangible and connected to what's going on and what's the leading edge and what's next, and how do you explore what's next. And so I expect huge things coming out of them. I want to point out something about, you know, technology learning is there's something that technology can do that we humans are terrible at doing. It's really inefficient. So technology, if one technology is trained to do something very, very well mm-hmm. and gets experience and perspective and can process things, well, that machine can transfer that learning 100% to any other machine that's prepared to accept it. Now, if you think about us here at this conference and all the we're learning, right? But it's such an inefficient process because we're sharing, trying to share in best interpretive ways to help more people understand what we know. And it's really imperfect. But technology can have perfect transfer.
So when I've got like a chip in my brain and then instead of having this interview, you'll just sit here and be like, bam, and then I'll be, oh, that's what you think.
And that chip's going to be expensive.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. It's so interesting. I remember I used to go out to Mobile World Congress all the time. So about 6 or 7 years in a row, and it always fell on my birthday, which was really annoying. But I remember there picking up, I think it was Time Magazine and it was free. And it was the Ray Kurzweil interview about singularity and all of this. And, you know, I remember sitting there reading it, just being like fascinated by it. You know, we'll see if what happens at 2045. What do you think about all of that?
I think we are going to see more this coding thing already hit us within the next 5 to 7 years, mm-hmm. within 10. I mean, if you think about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, mm-hmm. I mean, smartphones barely were useful.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, most of the social media happened in the last 10 years.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. The guy from Salesforce is always tweeting these things, isn't he?
Yes.
You ever see him? And it's like, yeah, when you list it out like that, it's massive. Yeah.
We didn't have Uber, you know, and today I don't even know what to do without it.
I was chatting to the guys from XPRIZE yesterday.
Yes.
And that's also very fascinating in terms of, I suppose, qualifying and acting as a qualifying force in terms of the efficacy of some of the initiatives out there and then just injecting like a huge amount of money behind it to, you know, act as a catalyst, because rather than all of us flailing around and having a go, it's quite interesting to try and act as that kind of prompt, I suppose.
We as a society have a huge opportunity, and where the technology is ready for this, to enhance the deepness and richness of our relationships between each other. And that happens through breaking down physical time-space barriers. It's about creating transparency of what's going on. And I think we have barely seen the potential of that. Yes, we have social media. We stay in touch with more people than we possibly could in our lives because of that. And that's hugely rewarding. But that's just the beginning of it. Mm. I think how we even how the user interface of a screen is designed, how do you reinforce that relationship, relevance, rigor, that biology flow? I think we have huge potential and a lot of work to do in that area.
And so how do you like relax when you're not thinking about these issues?
We hang out with people who are immensely creative, who are top of their fields in digital storytelling with films and television. One of my clients is Roland, the music company, and when we're friends, the head of creative there.
You're not sticking around this weekend.
No, unfortunately. But some of a lot of our musician friends are going to be here this next week. But it's about how do you make music more accessible and high quality music and sound? Because when we walk into a mall, noisy mall, and there's a live piano playing, we know it's a live piano. Mm. Isn't that amazing? You know, and there's something about the energy of that. But
this is really interesting because I was reading an article about how increasingly record companies are now working out like the magic mix of what makes a hit. So they can use a kind of algorithm and sort of identify like the perfect thing. And so that it got me thinking about, well, you could basically use an algorithm to work out like every single possible combination of music out there.
Oh, I've seen some technology that will blow your mind. It blows my mind, and the quality that comes out is
Makes you cry or something.
And you know it was put together and there was nothing like it. It was instant. I mean, it's unbelievable what's about ready to hit.
But at the same time, what I love is the fact that you just said that about the piano. Because I think the thing is you can't take away, well, you just can feel it, can't you, if something's created by a human.
That's right.
So it's getting that balance of the mix.
When Yo-Yo Ma hits that first note on his cello, there's something there, you know it's him,
yeah,
right? Well, digitally, the music industry has been hampered because of MIDI, which is basically 127 resolution steps. It's like taking a photograph and boiling down 127 colors. Well, the protocol that Roland just released is basically 27 million colors, so it's like full resolution. So when they sample Yo-Yo Ma hitting that cello, they can reproduce that sound.
So the reverberation textures of it.
The textures, the richness. And it's very strange because when you're playing a virtual instrument that is digitized this way, your body biologically responds to it as if you're playing that cello.
You put that together with like a VR experience as well, it could blow your mind.
That's right. Yeah. And so the high resolution, this is going to be something I think revolutionary. So that's what I'm very excited about. Mm-hmm. But it's also music is one of the most universal, powerful languages in the world, and it is so essential to learning. It's so essential to storytelling. It's mm-hmm. so essential. You watch some of the best movies in the world. You take away the movie score, it's terrible.
When I was 13, I watched The Shining, but I had to take the whole sound off because that's the bit that makes you scared, isn't it? The violins and the...
So
it's so important.
So we can't disassociate the music and sound element from what we are doing when it comes to true engagement and learning.
So you work across multiple industry sectors or verticals, industry terms. But that must then feed back into the educational experience because you can take these innovations that are happening and think, how does that apply within the school setting?
That's right. Mm. So, one of my goals is to bring $200,000 worth of studio quality virtual instruments into the palm of a kindergartner where they can compose and create. So music is so important to the biology of engagement.
There's a startup in the UK doing really interesting things called Study Tracks.
Yes.
Do you know those guys?
I'm very familiar with them.
Yeah, because he's an Ivor Novello winner, I think. Exactly that, create these amazing engaging experiences. And you see it with lots of these kind of YouTube videos of educators talking about the state of things, but turning it into whether it's a kind of musical-esque experience and then getting that point across really well.
And when we say biology, it's literally biology, because if you think about the percentage of cells or what percentage of your body is made up of water molecules, right? And
like a cucumber
and the and you have this electrical impulses and all that, and music creates vibration. Mm-hmm. And vibration at certain frequencies stimulate water molecules. And it loosens things up. It makes things so there's a fundamental. That's why when there's a certain song or there's a certain instrument, when there's certain musicians that have a voice, and you can see on a spectrograph the richness of all the frequencies of someone who sounds on tune and is on tune, but someone who's having hits and they have 50 times the density of frequency in their voice, even though it's technically the right tune.
Do you know Imogen Heap?
Yes.
I interviewed her at BETS, so that was really interesting.
And wonderful.
Finding out about how, her visit to MIT and developing the technology, and I guess that's another version of it, is how do you kind of kinesthetically communicate that to listeners, so it's not especially if you're using digital, that it's not just standing behind a laptop, and that's quite a selfish way of producing music sometimes, I think.
But you think about this, how music applies to education and how it's stuck in a band room, just like computers were stuck in a computer lab.
Yeah.
And when you are having kids do amazing work and creative work, and that's what you want as, you know, in your environment, you should be walking into a classroom or a work or that collaboration area, and kids should be listening to music. So can you imagine walking to a classroom and every kid has headphones on, right?
Well, have you heard of Now Press Play?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. That's their thing. The kind of silent disco experience. But one of my favourite primary schools to go and visit in Hackney. I loved it because I walked out afterwards and they were blasting out tunes in the playground. You know, so when all the kids are like having a bit of downtime rather than it being like really serious and droll, it's like, you know, amazing tunes, and it creates this experience of happy children, I think.
That's right. It's so powerful, and I think music is probably the most underutilized tool in the world around forming societies, but especially in schools. And it's always an afterthought. It's always an add-on, and we talk about art and music as like it is an appendage, and it really needs to be built into the core of what we're doing.
And who are your top three musicians or acts?
I am. Yeah, that's a very good question. A few months ago in the fall, went to a desert trip, and so saw Paul McCartney.
Really?
That was amazing. So I saw the Rolling Stones.
Yeah. I saw the Rolling Stones once in Montenegro.
And then Rihanna had a duet with Paul McCartney. That was really special.
Yeah. So I remember when they were doing the Olympics and they were rehearsing for the Olympic ceremony, and it's just around the corner from our house. So my husband and I went for a little walk around where we live, and you could hear him practicing. So we're chatting to a policeman there, and that Paul McCartney was sort of washing over the area. So it was really good. If people want to find out more about what you're up to, Ted, how can they follow you?
Follow me on my Twitter account and social media. It's my name, Ted Fujimoto. Also my website for company, consultlandmark.com. Then as far as the education stuff, we tend to put quite a bit up on righttosucceed.org.
Okay, wonderful. Thanks so much. Fascinating conversation.
My pleasure.
Big shout out to this week's sponsors, Glissa EDU. Glissa is an audience engagement platform, and they also have an education offer for socializing lectures, where they take regular PowerPoint or keynote presentations and push each slide out live to students' mobile devices as they are presented. Professors, administrators, and students get valuable data on where information is really engaging or needs reworking, and staff and students can interact through the deck. You can check them out at glissa.com/student-engagement. Thanks for listening, everyone. If you support the mission of the EdTech podcast, don't forget to spread the word or sign up to our Patreon campaign. Next week, we're back with K-12 EdTech Trends from South by Southwest EDU, and see you then.